Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In 1860, the conflict between anti- and pro-slavery forces had reached a point of two sides talking past one another. Sound familiar? A new political party, the Republican Party, was forming with a central tenet of containing and curtailing slavery. John Brown had launched an abortive attempt to foment a slave rebellion in Virginia just the previous year. Tensions were high, and already Southerners were contemplating the future of the country. Against that backdrop, a new book arrived from England, Charles Darwin's On the Origins of Species. That first book landed in the hands of four New England intellectuals on the first day of the year: social reformer Charles Loring Brace, abolitionist Franklin Sanborn, philosopher Bronson Alcott, the father of Louisa May Alcott, and author and naturalist Henry David Thoreau. Their reactions to the book, pro and con, would shape their work, lead weight to anti-slavery forces, and frame the beginnings of the ongoing argument about science versus religion that are still with us today. My guest chronicles their reactions to that book over the year 1860 in his new book, The Book That Changed America: How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. It's published by Viking. Randall Fuller is the Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa. He's also the author of From Battlefields Rising: How the Civil War Transformed American Literature, and Emerson's Ghost. He'll be talking about his book in a Book Smart Tulsa event tonight at 7 o'clock at All Souls Unitarian Church, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Randall Fuller, welcome back to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
You know, this book follows the reception of Darwin's On the Origins of Species when it first arrived in the United States in the Northeast in late 1859 and really the beginning of 1860. As you rightly point out in the book, the whole lead up to the Civil War and the breakup between the North and South sort of overshadows the important reception this book had. What was the reception? Now, you're looking at just the reception in the Northeast and the sort of the center of learning around Boston.
That's right. And I should say that as somebody who studied American literature and culture for a number of years, I always thought the reception of Darwin's On the Origin of Species didn't occur until after the Civil War. That's the typical narrative that historians have depicted about that book. But in fact, it came to the United States in December of 1859, which is about a year and 3 months or so before the Civil War. And it had an immediate and explosive impact upon the intellectual culture of New England. There were several forms of reception that the book took. One was religious, which we know about.
Stayed with us to this day, yeah.
That's exactly right. The religious press at the time, the Christian Examiner, the Methodist Review, were up in arms and wrote a number of reviews that were hostile or at least worried about Darwin's book. But what is less known is the reception the book received by abolitionists in New England.
And what's really interesting about that reception is it was two-pronged in and of itself.
That's right. The major issue that Darwin's book addressed for abolitionists was the question of the category of black people in America. There had been a long-standing scientific tradition in the United States, beginning in the late 1830s, early 1840s, that described all of the races of humans around the world as having been specially created, specially made by God in different places around the world, so that, for example, white people had been created in Europe, black people had been created in Africa, yellow-skinned people had been created in Asia. And the idea was that each of those races had been created in a special place, in a special environmental niche, with special and unique talents and qualifications. And
yeah, your book revives the term that's probably lost except to the people who really study this, and it's polygenism.
That's right.
I never heard of that term.
Yeah, that was known as polygenism, and the idea genism means creation, and poly means multiple or various. And the idea that humans were differently created, did not come from one source. And that's Darwin's great contribution to this argument by suggesting that all species are related and that over time, over an immense periods of time, evolved from one another, the notion of separate creation was exploded.
And of course, the other side of polygenism is it was used as a way of saying that the African race, blacks, were inferior to white or European-derived people.
That's exactly right. And there's this wonderful speech that Frederick Douglass gives before the advent of Darwin's book. This is in the mid-1850s. But it's a speech that he gives in which he says science is being used in the United States to justify slavery. And what he was talking about was the predominant theory of polygenism.
Now, really, the whole term science was a new term.
That's right.
It's a 19th century term for all intents and purposes.
That's right. And one of the things that attracted me to studying this topic, I'm a literary scholar, is that science and literature were not as far apart in the middle of the 19th century as they would later become. It was perfectly normal for someone interested in the natural sciences to also be a very good writer. Darwin's grandfather, for example, was a poet and a natural scientist. And, of course, the hero of my book in many ways is Henry David Thoreau, who had a foot in each of those worlds.
In fact, the term often was a natural philosopher.
That's right.
That's
right. The term scientist doesn't actually come into usage until the middle of the 19th century, and I believe it's first coined in 1833 in England. And as you can imagine, it takes a while to gain currency.
Well, and actually by the time of 1850s, Frederick Douglass is now referring to this science designed to keep us enslaved. So he looks at science as a new tool of oppression.
That's
really
exactly right.
So the book begins on New Year's Day of 1860. I assume this is the first copy on the Origin of Species that came over from England. And it actually first landed with Asa Gray, who becomes a champion of evolution. He was a botanist at Harvard. And he loans it to a friend, and these four friends gather. They're all abolitionists on New Year's Day. Tell us about this meeting. Why was it special?
It's hard to imagine a more intellectually vibrant group of people gathered in the parlor of a house in Concord, Massachusetts in 1860 than this particular group. And as you said, the book was sent by Charles Darwin to his friend Asa Gray, who was a Harvard botanist who had actually helped him with some evidence for his theory. Gray was enormously enthusiastic about the book. I've looked at his copy of the book, and he's just scribbled comments in the margins in pencil on nearly every page. And he receives the book in early December of 1859, reads it, I think, as quickly as he can, and passes it on to a cousin of his named Charles Loring Brace. We've forgotten who Charles Loring Brace is, but he was, in fact, one of the inventors of foster care and child welfare reform.
Children's aid. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Social reform.
He ran what was called the Children's Aid Society in New York. He came up with a program that many of us know from PBS specials called the Orphan Trains, by which young orphans from the urban Northeast were sent to farm families throughout the U.S. And so he's vitally engaged in all sorts of reform movements. He's also what he himself calls a red-hot abolitionist. He had been invited to give a talk on New Year's Day, 1860, in Concord, Massachusetts. For somebody like me who studies American literature, Concord, Massachusetts is sort of our holy sacred space. It's where Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote and lived for almost all of his life. It's where Nathaniel Hawthorne lived and wrote for portions of his life. And of course, Henry David Thoreau was from there. So Charles Loring Brace goes on New Year's Day to give this talk about child welfare reform, not about Darwin's book. But after his talk, he's invited to the house of a fellow named Franklin Sanborn, another abolitionist who had supported John Brown in his raid on Harper's Ferry. And Sanborn had invited a couple of other people. One was Bronson Alcott, who is a transcendentalist philosopher and the father of Louisa May Alcott. And the other person was Henry David Thoreau. So those four people gathered around their dining room on the evening of the first day of 1860, when the United States was deeply anxious about his future. And they discussed two things. One was abolition, and the other was Darwin's new book. And that new book changed each of those people in different ways over the course of the year.
And this is what the book really follows, the course of this next year from New Year's Day to basically the end of December of 1860. And I was talking about the reaction to this two-prong reaction from the abolitionists. First, they say, wow, this is a powerful argument in the fact that despite what certain scientists were telling us, that blacks are not inherently inferior. In fact, we all evolved from it. And even though the book is related to botany and small insects and the like, they immediately extrapolated this to humans, correct?
That's exactly right. And that was not a reaction that occurred only in the United States. And you're right, Darwin famously mentions nothing about human beings in On the Origin of Species. He kind of wisely or cannily keeps that conversation out of the book. But that didn't prevent all kinds of readers to immediately make these leaps to human evolution. And so in England, there's a great debate throughout the first year, 1860, about humans and their relations to primates. In the United States, that argument has more to do with whites and blacks because of slavery.
Yeah, and so on the one hand, they're excited about this because this becomes a weapon in their arsenal in the fight against slavery. We have to remember, these are all part of the great religious revival of the 18th century. They're intensely religious people. It doesn't take them long to go, okay, God is not controlling every action and creation of every species. This is a natural process. And this leaves them sort of somewhat, at least some ambivalence to the reaction to it.
That's exactly right. I use the term Trojan horse at one point. That is, Darwin's book is a kind of Trojan horse. Under the guise of one set of ideas, it releases all sorts of other troubling ideas. And as I said earlier, those intellectuals who were deeply religious, and America was a deeply religious place in the middle of the 19th century, really had to grapple with Darwin, some of Darwin's notions. Evolution as a theory had been around for a while, but what Darwin introduced to the discussion was a purely physical process, which made the creation of new species possible and plausible. So, as you know, in the 19th century, most Protestant Americans believed that human beings had been created in the image of God, that God had created each and every animal and plant, more or less as had been described in the book of Genesis and the Bible. What Darwin does is call that into question, or at least undermine that particular narrative by saying there's no need to have divine intervention here for, let's say, a wolf to develop from a previous species. The great American intellectual Henry Adams said that he read and enjoyed Darwin's On the Origin of Species because it, quote, wrecked the Garden of Eden.
Well, the second reaction takes place shortly after the first.
That's right.
How did these four men react to this in their various ways?
So the most visceral reaction against Darwin's On the Origin of Species occurred with Bronson Alcott. Bronson Alcott was the oldest member of the group who dined on New Year's Day. He was famously known as the most radical transcendentalist in America. And what that meant really is he believed God suffused every aspect of nature. He could not ultimately accept or adopt Darwin's theory. It was a bridge too far for him. And so, in fact, he renounces it. He calls it a dispiriting materialist philosophy and ultimately recoils from it without engaging it very much. Charles Loring Brace, the reformist, would say that he read the book 13 times in the next couple of years. And what he did is what I think many people do with Darwin's theory, which is he made it fit what he wanted it to fit. He shaped or used Darwin's theory to bolster his ideas about abolition and about the poor, But he never gave up on his deep religious beliefs, and he sort of was able to just live with both of those beliefs in his head.
And you mentioned the poor. This is a good. This is another side story of Darwin. Is I always think of those orphan trains as the orphan new settlers, and they take them out west. Those kids were considered inferior, that they had been created in a way that was all they could expect to achieve in their life. I mean, there was basically this belief that there were entitled people and unentitled people. And so he uses this for his crusades for the poor.
That's exactly right. One of the things I think you're describing is what would later become known as social Darwinism.
Right.
This idea that occurs in the 1870s and 1880s, well after the Civil War, that the rich are rich because they're better suited and better adapted to conditions. The poor are poor because they're not. And eventually the poor will either adapt or die off. And that's this very harsh and cruel social theory that emerged from Darwinian thinking after the Civil War. Charles Loring Brace didn't think that at all. Brace took from Darwin's book was that all races were moving in a progressive, better adapted direction. And so what he wanted to do is try to provide the background that would make poor people be able to thrive and to become fully integrated into American society.
My guest today is Randall Fuller. He's the Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa and author of the new book, The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. It's published by Viking, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. We mentioned the first two members there, but certainly the member that perhaps that this book had the most influence on was Thoreau.
Yes. Henry David Thoreau, I make the case, was the one person in the United States best equipped to understand and engage Darwin's book as thoroughly as possible. Asa Gray, the botanist that we mentioned earlier, was an incredibly well-trained scientist who agreed with Darwin and who certainly understood the scientific argument and the empirical evidence. But Henry David Thoreau was not only a gifted natural observer, but he was also a completely creative and original thinker. Most of us know about Thoreau, the hermit who lives in the cabin on Walden Pond, who doesn't pay his taxes because he's protesting the Mexican War of the 1840s. But there's another side to Thoreau that is less known, and that's the Thoreau who's rabidly reading every scientific text that comes out, who's walking through the woods of Concord every single day for 4 or more hours, taking notes of the kinds of things in nature that he observes. And when he first encountered Darwin's book, it hit him like a thunderbolt. It really, I argue, it changed the direction of his career, because he'd been collecting evidence for almost 10 years. But
writing, too, but not collated in any sort of systematic way.
That's right. There was no system. There are these just wonderful dozens and dozens of notebooks that Thoreau kept of things that he observed, whether it was the day in April that Walden Pond lost its ice or the day in September that the sweet gum lost its first leaf. I mean, he was looking at things in that kind of granular detail. But he didn't have a system. He didn't really have a theory. He knew that he was doing it for something, but he didn't quite know what that something was. And Darwin showed him how a theory can actually make all of that evidence cohere. That evidence and theory go hand in hand and kind of converse with each other. So you go out in nature, you see these changes. If you don't have a hypothesis about why those changes are occurring, it's just sort of data, but it doesn't mean anything. And Darwin's theory for Thoreau was really created a light bulb to go off in his head.
So you've seen the writings, I'm sure. How do the writings change from before Darwin to after Darwin?
Well, the big thing that changes is almost as soon after reading Darwin as possible, Thoreau digs out all of his notebooks and he begins to go through them and he begins to collate all of this information. He creates what I think might be the very first spreadsheets. There are these enormous newspaper-sized pieces of paper with graphs, and they'll have every month listed, and they'll have every species of plant and animal listed that he observes, and he's beginning to tabulate them and to determine this is the time when squirrels hibernate, this is the time when geese fly south, and all of those kinds of details. And he's clearly putting all of his data into some kind of manageable form. For a project, to be honest, none of us exactly know for what. We still don't know what his big idea
and because he died before.
That's right. That's right. In fact, at the end of 1860, Thoreau is still out in the woods attempting to find new data by counting the rings of trees. And it rains on him, and he catches bronchitis, and that develops into tuberculosis, which a number of his family members had died from, and he's not able to complete his great final work.
Now, we mentioned Asa Gray at the beginning. It was his copy. You happened to see the book.
I did.
What was that experience like, seeing
It was an experience like I've never had before. I first read about this single copy in a biography about Thoreau. I just learned that he had encountered the book on New Year's Day. And I started nosing around. And the beautiful thing about all of these people is they wrote letters and diaries and journals. And so I just looked around until I discovered that who owned that book. I then contacted Harvard University to find out if they still had the copy of it, and in fact, they did. So I went out there. I sat at a table with this really formidable podium in front of me, and a librarian came with cotton gloves on her hand and put this book in front of me and opened it up gently and told me that no one had looked at it by their records for probably 50 years or so. And I got kind of a shiver down my spine because I could suddenly see this book that had markings through it and imagine that not only had Asa Gray read it excitedly, but it had been in Concord on that fateful night in 1860.
Yeah. And we should mention Asa Gray because he becomes one of the earliest defenders of Darwin. And he was like, in many ways, Brace. He made it fit how he wanted. He was still a man of God. He had trouble with this idea that God was superfluous in creation, but he was absolutely a passionate defender. And what's also interesting is this conflict between this other Harvard, in the case of zoologist, Agassiz.
Yes, that's right. Asa Gray is so fascinating because on the one hand, he is one of the most accomplished scientists in America in the first half of the 19th century. And on the other hand, he is an incredibly devout Presbyterian who walked around campus with a Bible in his hand. And he was able for much of his professional life to hold those two ideas together because his notion was God had created every plant. So by studying botany, he was essentially studying God's method and he was glorifying God further. Along comes Darwin, and with a pretty convincing theory that says God isn't necessary for the species by species creation of plants and animals. And Asa Gray has a deep crisis, a deep intellectual and religious crisis. And where he comes out is to say, I believe that evolution and natural selection are the ways that God works in the physical universe. And in fact, that position is one that has been adopted by many, many people, but he's the first person to really articulate it. He articulates it in juxtaposition with Louis Agassiz, who was the most prominent, an amazing scientist who had come over from Switzerland in the 1840s and quickly became the face of science in the United States, but who was also the central theorist of that idea I mentioned earlier, special creationism.
Yeah. And what's really interesting is even in 1860, the divides that still sort of surround evolution were very much in place in which today, you know, the scientific, you know, it's talking about complexity and the opponents are fairly simple arguments. And so it makes it difficult for the public to discern sometimes.
I think that's right. And I mean,
it's just the rhetoric involved with this.
I think that's exactly right. And one of the reasons that the topic interested me so much was because I do see it in contemporary life. Also, the questions about race that the book addresses are still with us, maybe in somewhat different form, but the question of how African Americans are to be integrated into white society is a question that I think is still with us to some extent.
And this is all taking place during the course of a year, 1860, yes, which is also seeing a tremendous presidential contest in which a newcomer, a virtual unknown, becomes president, and the Union is literally on the verge of dissolving. It must have been an incredible year as you're watching these people wrestle with evolution at the same time they're wrestling with the future of the country.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why I think Darwin's idea sort of dropped in and made sense to so many people in 1860. The year begins right after this famous raid on Harper's Ferry by John Brown. And it was an effort to arm slaves and to create a slave revolt that would overturn slavery in the United States. And what that revolt or that effort at a revolt ultimately did was divide and polarize and galvanize the nation further than it had been before. So on January 1st, 1860, one of the things I was really interested in was reading all of the editorials in the newspapers across the country. And they're all full of fear and anxiety. What's going to happen to us? What will the nation survive this year? The newspapers from the South say the North is trying to impose its will upon us. It's trying to change our entire society by eliminating slavery. It's hostile to us. It wants to eliminate us. And the North is essentially saying the same thing. The South is trying to take over politically the entire United States. So you have this language right at the time that Darwin's book appears of survival of the fittest. Both the North and the South are describing their struggle with each other as one of these two peoples will survive, but the nation cannot continue divided. And, of course, the person who says that most eloquently is Abraham Lincoln with his House Divided speech. Lincoln comes out of nowhere, like certain other presidents that we've had in our history, comes out of nowhere and rises to prominence and becomes the president of the United States by the end of 1860, but with enormous antipathy, especially from the South, and not much of a mandate by the end of that year. And people simply don't know through 1860 where the nation will go.
Mm. Well, it's a really interesting book of this year and the reception of this so important book in our history. Randall, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Randall Fuller is the Chapman Professor of English at the University of Tulsa and the author of The Book That Changed America, How Darwin's Theory of Evolution Ignited a Nation. It's published by Viking. He'll be speaking about the book tonight at a BookSmart Tulsa event that takes place at 7 o'clock this evening at All Souls Unitarian Church. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.